always held the belief that it's a fallacy and quite frankly disrespectful that rock music is regarded solely as a domain of men. The rock and pop landscape is peopled with highly successful female artists, going back to the likes of Big Mama Thornton, Janis Joplin, Grace Slick, and Joni Mitchell. In recent decades, Stevie Nicks, Heart, Alanis Morissette, Chrissie Hynde, Tina Turner, Debbie Harry, and the list is endless. Strong women who have taken on the male-dominated music world at their own game, forged their own fire, and carved their names in the annals of contemporary music. Having tasted rock stardom early in her career, my guest in this episode has gone on to a successful solo career and is an inspiration role model for independent female artists. From the Hip is proud to host the multi-talented singer-songwriter Wendy Oldfield. Hey, Wendy.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, and you?
I'm good, thank
good
you.
Good to have you. God,
nice
it's been a long
be
time.
Yeah, it has, eh, Benji?
We go way back to the Jagger's day.
I think I've been doing this longer than I haven't. You know, it gets to that when you suddenly I've been in this business for 41 years this year, and I started when I was 19. I'm 60 now.
Right.
So it's been longer than it hasn't.
We both share that. Well, what were your earliest musical memories when you were growing up? What do you recall about that process?
I was always the singer girl, right from when I was in grade two. I was the lead of one of the school plays that we did. And then I carried on singing, you know, being the lead in the choir. I did a lot of musicals. Musical theater was my first sort of introduction into singing. And I love musical theater. That's where harmony work and everything cheapens. You learn a lot. And then rock and roll.
Well, I mean, a lot of the singers that I've spoken to come from musical theatre. I mean, you know, PJ used to do it. Claire Johnston used to do it. So it's a real grounding base.
It's like church or choir or that kind of thing. A lot of the musicians come from that school, you know, which is fantastic. It's a great, it's a solid background because of all the harmony work, you know. Yeah. It's absolutely divine. And then you head on to rock and roll after that.
Well, that's what happened. You got bitten by rock and roll. How did you meet the late John Mayer, the founder of Sweat Band? Had you seen him live? How did you land up fronting this rock and roll band?
It's a sheer luck. I wanted to be a singer. And when I was in matric, my mother made me, she always hates me when I say that, I never made you go and look at that day, you know, when they come around and they offer you stuff and you can study this and that. And I sort of wasn't very interested in anything because I was going to be a singer. And then my mom worked out that, oh, you can get a bursary, a teaching bursary, if you have a matric exemption. So why don't you go and study teaching? And so I said yes and did everything. And then 2 days before I started studying, she said, well, aren't you ready? And I was like, no, I'm not going to do it. And then she was like, you are going to do it, my girl. And so off I went to teaching college. And I often say to young people, just go ahead, walk forward, because this is what happened to me. In my second year of teaching college, everyone got to know me as the singer girl because I had a little a cappella group. And this girl came up to me and said, do you want to sing in a band? And I said, yeah, I'd love to sing in a band. And she said, well, my boyfriend, his brother is a drummer of a band called the Sweat Band. And I went, you.
That name didn't appeal to you,
I was
did
like,
it?
Oh. And then she's, but I was super keen to sing for anyone. That was all I was interested in. And so I went to, they phoned me the next day. Leslie called me and he first asked me if I shaved my legs and if I would dye my hair. And I said yes. Then I went for an interview, an audition the next night, and I got in then and there. And the following night, we started rehearsing. I said goodbye to the rest of my life, and I stepped into a band that had been together for nearly 3 years already. And they had fallen out with their lead singer, or I can't remember exactly what happened, and I landed in this kind of up there. I didn't do band jammy for years. You know what I mean?
No rehearsal with other bands or?
No, nothing. I've never jammed in a garage with bands or done anything. I landed in a fully rehearsed with John Mayer at the helm, which I only now have gotten to realize how amazing and incredible that was. I mean, it was up there. I just thought that's how it was. It was just, there was the bar.
It must have been nerve-wracking.
No, because I didn't know what I was being nerve-wracked into, or that it, I only realized later on how, you know, I mean, how amazing John was. It's sort of, I just knew him as John, and that's how brilliant he was. I mean, I got to see his, the level of respect that people had for him, obviously, as sort of I went along. But I was very lucky that.
But it was very much a boys' club, wasn't it, the band?
My band, or bands in particular.
Your band, Sweat Band.
I was one of the boys. I was scarier than all of them together.
Lovely.
You sort of have to be. Have you met Cindy? Cindy Alter.
Yeah.
You can see we're the same. We cut from the same cloth.
How difficult was it then, being almost a, you know, a newbie in that world? How difficult was it to traverse a very male chauvinistic music society? Because let's face it, you were probably, as far as I know, the only real rock and roll singer at that time. How difficult was it in that world?
I never even thought about it.
Okay.
I speak man. My boyfriend calls me a bad, bad man sometimes. But I never thought about it, actually. When somebody asked me how it is to be a woman in the music business, I went, oh, me, what I'm... I don't know. It's fine. I'd never thought about it because I've always thought of music as a, you are a thing. It's not being a woman or a man, or you represent a certain energetic function within and like this structure, and you all fit together. And I never thought about it as being a man or a woman thing. I just...
You just were.
I just were.
So you never really had to prove yourself as an equal of anybody in the band or any other musicians out there. When you got together with them in those rehearsals and certainly in the early live dates, was there like an energy, a synergy between the four of you?
We, from the first night, from the first audition we had, I still remember John walking into the lounge, that funny walk of his. He came in and he said, "Hello, I'm John." And kind of bent, you know, had he like sort of had that strange way about him, kind of awkward, shy. And he sang me a song, and then I learnt it, and then I sang it for him, and then I sang another one, and they said, "Right, you're in." And the following night, my mom said, "Oh, look, that's nice. You'll be able to, bye." And then that was it. And she was like, you go, oh. And then the band was my one and only thing that we never, ever missed a rehearsal. I missed my best friend's wedding because we had a rehearsal on Saturday. And you didn't miss a rehearsal. It just wasn't ever done. And no one ever missed a rehearsal. No members of the band. We were completely and absolutely committed. I think it's probably the best time when I think about the best time you have, because you've got all the expectations of success and the will, and you're so driven. Your belief is 100% in what you're saying, and you have something behind, not just fame. You have something else, a need to express what you're talking about at the times, which we were very interested in, you know. This boy is a point in case.
But I mean, that energy that you had, did you feel like, this is something really special and that we're going to happen. Something's going to break.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a four-way street. It's so nice. You're not in charge. No one's in charge. It's like you're just this four-piece, and if you lose money, everyone does. No one blames, or it's like you one thing. And you get that when you lose that when you become Wendy Oldfield, you know. Then no matter how often I've tried to get a band together, it's never like that, because once you step into a solo thing, you don't step back into a band thing.
It's difficult to kind of level back into that.
So that's the one sort of time I'm like, the band, man, no one messes with the band. The band was the thing. We were the band. We'd meet outside if we were going to see any other band, and we'd walk in together. We'd always walk in together.
Like just, a little gang.
Like a little gang, yeah. It was excellent.
So those early days, you were originally based out of Cape Town. I mean, you must have played every bar
and every dive for literally no money. What memories do you have of that period of your career before the bubble went up?
Well, there were a lot of Free People's concerts at that stage. And we used to, my first gig was at the Pig and Whistle in Rondebosch. We made 25 rand each, I remember, 100 bucks. We actually made money. That was what you got on a Thursday night. I think the venue paid us 100 rand. And I think we still had to set up our own sound. We didn't have monitors. I didn't know what monitors were until we did our first festival. And then I said to Dieter, they haven't turned the speakers around in the front of the stage. And he said, the monitors, they are for you. And when I came on, I was like, oh, I think I was the only singer ever to tell them to please take my monitors down. Because I still had to get used to
working
being able
with,
to listen to myself. Yeah. And so that was amazing. And then we used to carry the sound system all the way up at UCT to yellow level. And we would play at lunchtime at yellow level. We'd set the whole band up and we'd play. And we did it often, dragging the PA around different places in UCT.
But that all that playing obviously tightened the band incredibly.
The band was already tight.
Was it? Kicking.
Like I said, I just got in there and John had time, man. We would spend a whole rehearsal just going like the whole movement of everything from the way it went down and the dynamic of it, and we were solid.
Did you have creative differences on how things were arranged in terms of no?
No, we didn't. Mostly John led the band in that way. I ran my own ship when it came to how I sang and how I projected it. The rhythm section just got on with being the rhythm section.
They were very tight. I mean, John was an amazing guitar player. One of the best ever, I think, that I've ever seen. I've seen a lot of great guitar players around the world. And certainly a live wire performer on stage. Did you at any time feel intimidated by all that wildness, or did you just immerse yourself into the flow?
Oh, yeah, I immersed myself in it. I mean, John took the mixing desk off stage one night with himself, like throwing himself around. He went off the stage with the mixing desk, landed, it wasn't far, like a meter, landed on the desk, still playing, while everything was still going. Nothing got pulled out. He lay there and finished his solo on the desk, on the ground. You know, it was brilliant. And he could do that.
He was that gifted.
He was that gifted.
I want to read you back to your description of the Sweatband.
Okay.
At Jaggers. No one who was at the old Jaggers nightclub in Rosebank will ever forget the sight or the sound of Dieter Stütz, Leslie Cook laying down the wicked rhythm grooves, sultry sex siren Wendy Oldfield wailing her soul all the way to Valhalla, and manic guitarist John Mayer prowling the aisles and tables of the club with his 100-foot lead, a flying V ablaze, ripping, shredding, hammering out cascading notes of pure rock guitar genius. No one rocked harder than the Sweatband. Is that how you remember it?
Yes. Just every night would be a sweat fest, literally. At Jaggers, John, they used to keep a fire extinguisher there, because when it suddenly came to that, John would be in and then he would be spraying himself with lighter fluid and lighting the guitar.
I remember it so well.
In the middle of Jaggers, I mean, there were curtains there. It's like it was crazy.
And he stuck with that flying view a long time. He had all those burn marks on it.
No, he still played it forever.
Did that side of the band ever get out of hand? I mean,
no.
Where you suddenly went, whoa.
No. I mean, in retrospect, we could probably look back and say, you know, we were sponsored by Esprit when we played. We were the first and only original South African band to get a Holiday Inn's residency. We got a 3-month residency, 5 nights a week, 4 sets a night. At the Holiday Inns in Pretoria, Daisies, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. So off we came here. I think this boy had been released. Mm-hmm. And we did 3 months there. We'd sleep from Sunday until Wednesday, you know what I mean? And We were night owls, and we'd rehearse every single day. We would rehearse. We'd go down from 4 to 6. We rehearsed every single day. That's how dedicated we were. We had 78 songs in our repertoire, I think.
All original.
All original that we could play brilliantly, all of them. That's what we rehearsed, everything. And then while we were there, we got a gig at Jagger's. This guy came in to see us,
Leon Economides.
Leon Economides. And he came in to see us, and he said he'd like to book us at Jagger's. And we were like, oh, another 3-month residency. I mean, unusual, you know, that happened. And it's not like now where you can check in where your song is doing or whatever. We didn't really know much what was going on the radio because we were stuck in this hotel. So we go to Jagger's our first night. This is classic. And we set up in the afternoon, and we had a thing where we'd do a very clean stage in grey, and we'd hide all the cables. So we had a very clean and open stage. And we went and set up. We'd come down the stairs through Tivoli Restaurant down into Jagger's that way around. And set up everything. And then we left, went home, came back, got a bit lost and thought, okay, well, we'll park in Oxford Street. We didn't know where anything was. And we got out the car, and there were just queues going around the block. So we got back in the car. We thought we were at the wrong place. And we drove back to the place we'd gone in the afternoon. And then we went down the stairs and we realized, oh my God, they're here for us. We walked in like we were in trouble, sort of in between the people. And then we sat in the manager's office and just went, fuck, yeah. Like that. It was incredible. And that's what every night was like when we were there.
It was a real high, wasn't it?
Yes, it was fantastic. It was like 15, you know, when you have your 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah.
That was kind of like how it was at that time for us.
But I mean, you sported a very rock and roll attitude and look. You had the black leather skirt, you know, moving on stage, Manic John running around, the band sitting tight. At one stage, it looked like you were all wearing the same clothes. I mean, how did that look evolve? Was there a conscious decision to go, we're going to wear black leather, rock and roll?
No, we started off making the worst decisions. I promise you, the sweatband, we wore sweatbands, yellow sweatbands.
I've seen that photo.
In those white, like, onesies. Zip up overalls, I suppose. And we had our hair cut exactly the same. We had it peroxided white and then dyed like the darkest blue, black blue. feather cut mullets.
As it was in those days.
And then we had, it wasn't for long until we were called the White Giants in a review. You know, remember that ad with the guys in the white overalls?
Oh, yes, pouring the Omo, right.
So that never again, we didn't wear those again. And we sort of just developed into that look. It wasn't, we never spoke about it or anything.
It just
sort of happened. You know, you rock and roll black, easy to travel with, makes
yep,
you look
absolutely.
Thin.
Don't have to wash it too often.
Don't have to wash it too often.
What was it like touring with a sweatband? I mean, some of the funny moments of being on the road with three young, virile males.
They're all disgusting, probably, the stories. We slept in a friend's flat one night. There was one bed. So it ended up being myself, Dieter, and Leslie, I think. And John ended up in the shower in the bathroom with his head on the little shower step as he's, and he had such thick contact lenses, and there was a big puddle of gob that he'd stuck the contact lenses into. and he woke up with his lenses in next to him in a big pile of gob. Anyway, I remember that very clearly. And then he took them out, sucked them off and popped them back in his eyes.
So, you were very focused as a band, right? I mean,
yes.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, was that part of the experience?
After the gig.
Never on stage.
Never on stage. The band drank quite a lot.
Mm.
But I left the band. I don't know what happened after that, but we never really got into drugs or anything. We were heavy drinkers. But we were youngsters as well, you know.
Yeah, we all were in those days.
I was 19 when I started.
Wow.
And 21 when I moved to Joburg with them. Well, when we all moved.
How did you get signed by Patrick van Blerk at PVB? I mean, I know Martin Drake, I think, was involved, the late Martin Drake.
Mm. He brought Patrick to see us at Jagger's.
Mm.
And Patrick fell in love with John, I think.
Yes.
And I think Patrick took him jawling one night after the gig. And we were like, John, you got to get this for us. We put mascara on him and everything, and we sent him off into the lion's den. And that night he came home in Patrick's Porsche. And it's because Patrick was so drunk that he couldn't drive. So John drove it, dropped him off at home and came home. And the next day we went to drop it off, and Patrick came out and he said, I'm so sorry that I got so drunk, but I'm not sorry I tried to get into you.
That's but very
like, as Patrick in front of everyone like this, John was just he was so embarrassed, fresh little Cape Town boys, you know, in the scene. Patrick was divine and we loved him, had a great relationship with him, yeah, very lekker.
So he signed the band
and then I think released through his label and something to do with Peter Cook as well,
yeah,
but my memory is hazy.
Yeah, PVB Records.
Yes,
let's talk about doing the album with Kevin Shirley, who's gone on to be a serious producer, rock producer, Aerosmith, Zeppelin, et cetera. He was still based in Cape Town at that particular point. What do you remember about the recording of the album?
He was still a newbie also at that time. I personally don't really like the recording.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is, I don't know, it's a bit brash. And it also didn't really read the sweatband. If you saw us live, it was a different thing to the recording.
It's a common thing with rock bands.
So you
bands.
Have an idea of how it's going to sound, but we were much gnarly. We were way more gnarlier than that.
Mm.
And it sort of came across as sort of a little mainstreamy in a way, which we weren't live.
She walked into the cafe like she knew she ought to do. The clothes she wore, right amount, and a smile was expensive too. You could see the back of her body, running naked to the waist. You would pay the earth for a taste of the salt on her tan. The eyes in many hand, chance to see through cotton shape of her body, shape of her body, shape of her body, shape of her.
I mean, you had out-and-out rockets like Shape of Her Body, 200 watts.
200 watts, yeah.
And then you had the kind of more
doing
poppy
to somebody
things like,
and, yeah.
You know, like Tonight and UB Johnny.
Yes.
Do you think it was a conscious decision to try and straddle the two markets, the rock market and the pop market?
You know, John, just, you mean the recording of the album?
Yeah, just the general direction of the band, because you're quite right. Live, you were a kick-ass 100% rock and roll band. And the album, I think you're quite right, suffers a little bit on the production side.
I think maybe that served us in terms of the radio play.
Mm.
But for just my own personal thing is I wish there was more live recordings of us.
Because
that's where we really shone was in the live thing. It was,
there John must
was
be a, somewhere.
John was electric. I mean, he was incredible.
He was incredible. I mean, of course, I think, did you release Tonight as the first single or was it Shape of Her Body?
I think This Boy was.
Was This Boy the first single?
First single
So that's the one that resulted in the breakthrough,
as you said.
And you suddenly saw all these people. Did you think it was a hit up front? Did you go, wow, I think it's a smash?
Yeah!
We didn't really have any expectations about that. We didn't really know how it worked or anything. And the next minute we had a single out and we knew that it got radio play.
And it changed everything, right?
And then it changed everything. It was on all the stations. You know, at that time, South African stations played South African music alongside international music.
Yeah.
And if you got a number one, you were worthy of it. And we sailed around the early 125s with lots of songs, you know, as on different stations, and everyone played us. It wasn't like a special
and you were
station
up there. You
for
were on, yeah, you were on all the bills.
Yeah,
and
on all the
in
bills.
In the magazines and
anything. And so were a lot of other South African music. Weeping was one of them as well. That was played on all the stations across as a – and so was Acid Rain. As well.
Was there, with you being the front person really and having a foil in John, I mean, was there ever any tension within the band that you were getting too much of the focus?
Well, that was kind of the demise of the band at the end. John and I, funnily enough, probably 2 weeks before he died, 2 to 3 weeks before he died, we got together for a show. It was happening in Roodepoort at the big, it was an 80s show.
I was there.
Yes. Mm. And so we rehearsed for a week before, which was amazing because it was 10 years after the band had split up, maybe even longer. No, roundabout. So there we are rehearsing and talking about what happened. So we had so much closure between all of us around that past time. And there was no problem with the band. And we loved each other desperately. We'd kind of got some worms in the mix. Martin and Andre de Villiers had come in and had their ideas, and suddenly this thing that we'd always made our own ideas was sort of getting...
Often happens that, doesn't it?
I mean,
when a band has some success, the I always call them the vampires.
Yeah, we were absolutely up to then, and then suddenly... And my boyfriend was the sound engineer, and they didn't have a good relationship with him. So the division sort of became like Wendy and Dave and the rest of the band. Mm. If they had just spoken to me and said, break up with your boyfriend, I would have gone, yeah. I would have chosen that.
The band over the anybody.
It was the band over anybody. It just ended up being strange. And then the management coming and saying, well, we've had a talk with the band. Now, there's the band sitting and telling me that I'm taking too much front power. Mm. And because it started becoming Wendy Oldfield and the Sweat Band. Mm. And that wasn't because of us. It was what magazines chose to do.
It's not uncommon, though.
It's not uncommon.
In music. John May wrote most of the songs. However, you chipped in on the first album with Louis, and you co-wrote two others. Was that the beginning of your writing career? Did John influence you in any way? Hey, you got to write. Or did you just go like, I want to write?
I just started, I want to write. I started thinking like that and I started writing more and more. However, my sound, my style wasn't sort of really in the Sweat Band niche, I suppose.
Mm.
So I was raring to go, actually, when the band split up. Then I had songs under the belt, and of course everybody loves you.
What really happened with the Sweat Band? I mean, you did this album. I mean, you were set to be one of the biggest things to happen out of this country. Who knows where it could have gone? What happened? What really led to the breakup?
That sort of thing was happening. Martin and Andre had their own agenda going, and there was a sort of a bromance happening, and with Andre and the dudes, and he was kind of, I don't know, building up their egos, and Martin like, oh, you guys, listen, sort of to the point of almost you don't need Wendy. It's John was the Sweat Band and Wendy this and. Because this all came out in the conversations we had later. And that it was actually one of John's biggest regrets. After the Sweat Band died, he really got into hardcore drugs and drinking because it was his, this boy. It was about him, this boy.
Yeah. But, I mean, the breakup must have rocked you. I mean, you were 19 when you joined them. You were there. It was like everything to you.
It was a divorce. It was terrible. I mean, they'd said to me, you got to think about giving, you got to give John back half the stage and do the interviews together, which I wouldn't have actually minded. But just being told that by management, and there the band was sitting there and everything, I was like, they said, think about it, we'll talk about it next week. And I just stood up and went, ain't no thinking about nothing, smell you later. And that was me, and I was out.
It's a hard decision to make.
Yes, it was. It was. There was a build-up, though, because of the things that started getting weird, and they were also weird to me, management and then the band, sort of, because obviously the guys had been talking about it. I could see there, you know, that my husbands were lying. And anyway, and so it was both sides, I guess, you know, because they saw that as well. Oh, Wendy's getting invited to do this and that without us. And so it does become, it's easy to get into a crack like that, you know, where there's suddenly more attention on one thing. John didn't care. He really didn't care. If he was, they didn't actually really care, the band. It just was designed sort of in that way, you know, and it broke John's heart, actually. And then they got two singers in, which was so not the...
I saw them.
Oh, yeah, John said it was...
The vibe was gone.
Yeah, and they were trying to do something for pop's sake. Mm. You know, Michelle was on guitar and she just learned to play three chords. And I think that was for John, just not with his musical integrity and everything, you know, just like trying to make something out of... They'd been persuaded this is a way better way than you never have one person ruling the band and now you've got two girls. And
but, I mean, what a lot of people don't know is that the Sweat Band finished recording a second album, but it was shelved. What was the background to that?
Well, we were going to release it, and then the next minute I'd heard that they'd actually try to get John to sing some of the songs, but they were too high, and then try to get the two girls that were singing with the band to sing, but that didn't work. And so it was basically a washout, you know, and took my vocals off. And I don't know what happened to it. I haven't heard it, but like you said, there's six tracks.
Yeah, I mean, there's some amazing songs on there. I mean, Just an Emotion, Nobody Else, Down in Africa. The writing seemed to have really matured.
Yeah.
They're great songs there. Do you think if these people hadn't interfered and that second album would have gone out, that you would have upped it to the next level?
Absolutely. I think John was 25. I was 21, 20. That's how young we were. Mm. You know, just there's a whole career there of already we'd done. I mean, we recorded an album on cassette.
Mm, I remember that.
You must try. That is beautiful. We recorded that album on a on a little two-track Tiak with four tracks. We had to bounce down everything. It's such a nice album. John did that on his own. And it's a very nice album. And you do get to feel the band like in that. And then we did another two. He would have carried on and carried on and gone to whatever you change, like Radiohead, you know. Like,
yeah, he was very prolific.
Yeah, he was very prolific. So, and he was only finding out about himself when you're 25, 26 years old, you know.
When you look back now with hindsight,
yes,
as we always do, what do you think a Sweatband's legacy is?
I really think that this boy, and that's from the feedback, so much feedback, because I didn't perform it. When I left the band, I was very interested in like carving up my own sound and... And also, it wasn't in that, this boy you can only play that way. Mm. Trust me. I've tried it.
Have you tried doing like an acoustic version?
And every kind of version, slightly slower, maybe swing straight up. It only will be played in that way. Acid Rain is flexible. It will, can be played from a samba to a rockabilly style. You can do it in any way. This boy, computer says no.
The day ends at sunset. Upon the sea, the sunrise warms the mountains and starts the day for me. The wind brings the rain in, turns the valleys green. It's a place I could hold. It's the most beautiful I've ever seen. And I can't get lonely just knowing that it's there. I love that place only and tell anybody that wants to hear. That down in Africa, there's a town that I prefer to anything that mine is made of. Any sum of money paid.
This will not compute.
This will not compute.
So in 91, after you left the band, did you have a clear idea of what you were going to do?
You think you do. I mean, geez, I've gone back and looked back at my career, different things, and I mean, you only think you know everything for then, for that moment, you know. Mm. This is what I'm going to do. I wrote very diverse songs when I first started out. They were, and I put in a few covers, but they were sort of, oh man, Thomas Dolby style, like that sort of thing. Mm. And then I got involved with Chris Kalakis, and I wrote most of the album with George Vardis, the first album that I
Beautiful
released
World.
With Acid Rain on it. Yeah.
Right.
I did with Kiki. and Cedric Sampson, Acid Ray and the ballad version.
Right.
And that was the first single that I did. And that came out, I think, in 89 or something.
I mean, you came out of the blocks like a racehorse on that solo, on that first album. I mean, you had you clocked up awards for best female vocal. You produced two of your finest songs, Acid Rain and Miracle.
Yeah,
which I love Miracle.
They were all hits, and Don't Stop Believing in Me. There were lots of like pop hits on that album, and it was a very successful album. She's saying it was so what a bloody nice thing, eh? I was at the same time, you know, as Prophets of the City and Batrenyecha, they were all the, those were all the 15 who'd got the 15 minutes of fame in at that time. So we were always on the same stages together with Brenda and Stimela. And I landed in this world that was just incredible. From Pine Landica in Cape Town to just suddenly in a few years' time standing on stage with Brenda screaming, "I love you, Wendy," from the audience. It was like I was blessed by the Queen, you know.
Right.
And just having these incredible experiences that I just took like as if that's just how it is, you know. And I didn't ever go, wow, here I am. I was too busy working. I was too busy working. It was about the work, you know. And the more the work happened, the more it ate me. And the less I became interested in the fame machine and more interested in the music. And so that sort of started splitting, from that. I don't desire public approval, especially musically.
I've noticed in your songs there's a very strong ecological slant. Where did the inspiration for Acid Rain come from? And do you feel that as a planet, we're really in dire straits?
You know, Acid Rain came from driving up to, I used to go to White River. My brother was living there and doing some work, and drove up for weekends, and we all had friends together and everything. And we used to drive through the Sappy and Mondi forests where they chop the and make the paper and all of that, where the factories are. And the smell, I mean, you could smell way before you even got there, a very particular smell. And so I sort of got to hear of the plight of Acid Rain by the people that lived there and everything, holes in their clothes. And I mean, can you imagine what it's doing to you besides that, you know, especially when the wind blows and disperses. And anyway, it was also South Africa at the time and very hard to write political songs or have anything, any say, because that gets censored. So it was trying to mush two ideas together, which is state of our country and an environmental issue, into one song. And that's how I came up with Acid Rain.
Answers, you know, I can't find. I wonder.
it's still relevant today, I suppose.
It is still relevant, which is why I'm like yawn when I think of the powers that be in climate change. How did I know about something 40 years ago, you know what I mean, or whatever, and no one did anything about it? Only time anybody does anything about anything is when there's when they need smoke and mirrors and they want to nick money or something. The climate change agenda is something that shouldn't be a yes or no thing. It's like everyone's interested in pollution. Everyone's interested in fixing the marine life. Everyone's interested in how you go about it. There's a conversation to be had, but there's no conversation to be had about climate change. It's just yes or no, and it makes me weary.
You can see the effects now of what's happened in the last 40 years with the weather patterns around the world. I'm sure you agree, as a planet, we're in
doomsday. We're in doomsday for two things. I think the planet will heal. We're the ones that must worry about ourselves. The planet's fine. I think that there's geo-bloody weather engineering going on. I've gone and looked into it. It's been going on for ages. I mean, you can look into the sky and see it. Supposedly, it's to block the sun from harming us or change the carbon situation. The first 1,000 delegates at the WEF flew in, dropped 2.5 million carbon tons of emission.
Right.
I won't listen to anybody who does that and tells me about carbon. It's like mic drop. That's as far as I'll go. So that's how I feel about the climate change thing. However, I do think there's acid rain still, and I do think there's pollution. And I do think it's about greed and industry and greed and all that sort of stuff. And we've got to clean up and pay attention to this beautiful place that we live and get healthy again.
Well, acid rain is still a perennial on radio. It's a great, great song. Talking about songs, they're like little babies, aren't they, songs? I mean, they have to be incubated and nurtured, and then they're born. Let's talk about songwriting. Does it come easy for you?
You know, songwriting is an evolving thing, and it changes all the time, especially as you grow, because you don't get older, you grow sideways and more. You become denser in your songwriting. It's not like you suddenly get sort of better in that way. It's you get fuller and it becomes the minutiae, the details. I won't let a line go anymore in a song if it's not right. You know, I can listen back to my albums and I know where that line was a line I didn't really pay much attention to because it fitted, sort of. I won't do that anymore. I respect the line before way too much to let something not work in full capacity, the weight of the words, the length of them, how the pentameter, you know, depends on what it sounds like. And it's not a conscious thing. I don't go into that. It just becomes more. So when I'm writing, I'm listening to the whole thing. It's more like often, I won't even know what it is that I'm saying,
right. But
it sounds so good that you feel what it is about. That's kind of what it becomes. I don't know. It's such an interesting process because I don't write the songs. I think about a lot of things, and those things have a way in my subconscious of making their way out my mouth.
So the songs write themselves then?
They write themselves because I'm not that clever. They certain ones with them, and then I sing a lot. So I come up with melody lines that will force their way back and again until I'm like, okay, there you are. I can hear this melody line repeating itself over and over. And then one word will come into it that's just perfect, a word in a whole melody line. And I'll just stay with that until the next word drops in. And suddenly I'll go, oh, damn, Wendy, that's brilliant. And then I might start working with the song and tying the pieces together or whatever. But I wait for it.
But you also go back sometimes. And Acid Rain, for instance, had several incarnations. And Pale Blue Dot also.
Here we are, floating somewhere among a million stars. And on this pale blue dot, I'll keep loving you from my heart on a blanket in my yard. And every time
I see a shooting star, it reminds me of my insignificance. And if the light that shone could have come from a star that has been and gone, I could have lived a million lives since. This pale blue dot that has been around for a fraction of time since this business began. And on a pale blue dot, I'll keep loving you from my mind in the garden under the sun. And every time I see a shooting star, it reminds me of my insignificance. And if the light that shone could have come from a star that has been and gone, could have lived a million lives.
Did you feel compelled to go back to those songs in order to improve it, or is it just your creative spirit taking over and going, well, you know, I want to reinvent this according to where I am right now?
I think that it's, like you said, they're your babies. And often I've sung a song live for 3 or 4 years, and suddenly something will happen in that song. And I was like, where was I? It was so obviously, glaringly obvious that that should have gone to a minor there. Why the hell didn't it happen? Or suddenly a change in a word or something like that. And then I think the best part about it is that I own it. I can do it again. I can do it again if I wanted to. And then it was, that's what it was then. In its state of history and where I was. And now this is, and not much, I changed, I did Pale Blue Dot again on my new album.
Yeah.
And that was because I recorded it the day after I wrote it, mm-hmm. 25 years ago. And I wrote it in one go in the car on the way back to listen to the mixes.
Right.
I wrote it, came out my mouth, and I got there. And Neil said, no, you're not doing another song. And I was like, well, it's the title of the album, so I must do it. So then we recorded the song and then we released it. So I never had time for it to grow vocally, you know, as it has done. So I wanted to do it again.
So there was a point where you went, I'm going to go revisit that and kind of...
Well, I've sung it ever since I wrote it.
Right.
So over the last 25 years, it's changed quite dramatically, yeah. And so I want, yeah, and it still does even more. So maybe I'll do it in the next 20 years.
Again.
I'll do it again, yes.
Over the years, you've been known as a great collaborator with, you know, countless musicians. Most notable, I suppose, your two-year stint with Mondetta, a collaboration with members of world music fusionist Tananas. Share that experience with the Mondetta thing, because, I mean, it was kind of different to what you were doing on the solo albums.
I started playing djembe, and I started getting more into world music.
Mm.
Going up to Rustler's Valley, and it was a very exciting time because it was different, like my ears suddenly going into another thing, and got into chanting and all kinds of world music, and that's sort of what started it. And I can't remember how Steve and I ended up. We had a band. We had a band called Man Walking. It was just, we just threw it together. It was Kaelin Thompson, myself, David Balilti on Darbuka, Steve, I don't think Jito was with us then. I'm trying to think. I think it was maybe just the four of us.
Mm.
And Steve hates a rehearsal. As we just jump on stage and we would just kind of make stuff up as we went along. Some of it was fantastic and some of it went on for too long. And one day I saw a poster there where they changed the man walking the L into an N. And you can see it there, man wanking. And I think I was with Steve. And we were like, we laughed about it. Anyway, it then became Mondetta with just Steve and myself. He'd met Julia, the phenomenal violinist, beautiful Korean-Canadian girl, and Elad Niman, Israeli, phenomenal percussionist. And Jita, I mean, what a bloody
amazing talent.
Yeah, and kudos to Tony Lancaster, because it was SAFM that paid for the album.
Right.
Well, it was through them because it was the SABC, and they did a whole lot of albums with different people. So off we went into M1 to go and write the songs even. We sat there and wrote for a week. Like
Jammed in the studio.
Just jammed in the studio. It was incredible, man. And so that album, yeah, came out of that. And then we played. Also, we were just onto big stages, and it was just a fantastic outfit. Yeah, fantastic. I love playing with him.
Why did that come to an end then?
Cheetah died.
Oh, it's when he would, that, well, it was the hijacking,
it was about a year after, but we had taken a, you know, a break because someone was doing something else and that. But the band wasn't over. We were, you know, continuing. It just didn't continue, which was devastating for South Africa. Chito Baloyi, what a loss.
Mm, yeah, Lucky Dube, yeah. Same story. I mean, yeah.
Man, it's terrible.
Very, very sad. I'm going back to something you said earlier, which just clicked with me now. Your work has been recognized by the industry. Throughout your career, you've won several awards, including Best Female Artist, Best Pop Album, two for your children's albums. But yet you've stayed very independent of the industry. Do you think that you feel vindicated on the one hand by having these accolades from the industry, but at the same time being able to walk away from it and just be creative?
You know,
it's like a love-hate relationship.
It sort of is. I find it hard to believe the bullshit.
Mm.
You know, I see the way that, I mean, they've got song apps now that teach you how to cheat songwriting.
Wow.
It's like if you get stuck, you can try this. Well, you know, this, and also these are all the words that they can rhyme with this. And here are ideas for content. I'm like, it's songwriting. It's like, it's all in the words, songwriting. It's like what you do. You become a human being that has a thing towards that. And then you have a special way of telling a story that is delivered. That's amazing. And you can change people. And you can, but just the way you feel, and you don't, just you, your authenticity. You only need one Beyonce. You only need one, you know. They can't be you, no matter how hard they try to try. Like, so you've got one job to do, and it's like...
To be true.
Because you feel it through the music. Truth is something that resonates through any format.
Well, that's the thing about you. You are fiercely independent. I think the attributes I think really apply to you is that word, authenticity. There's no hype, there's no bullshit about you as an artist. You also seem to perhaps struck the perfect balance with being a creative person and being a sort of a cog in the family, the family thing. Because the family life is very important to you, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, kids, I had 3 kids in 3 years. So somebody said on purpose, I was like, are you mental? No one does that on purpose. And 3 beautiful kids that are in all 21, 22, and 23, nearly 24. So, amazing. Actually, it was the first time I took my whole music career, which was a 360-degree cake. Nothing else existed.
Mm.
To suddenly just being a slice of the cake, which was amazing. Like, actually going, it's not like music is my life. It's actually, I have a life, and music is part of it. And that creativity comes in many formats, you know what I mean? And I never really took time off in the sense of, you know, blocking it out. It was just naturally sort of done, and you know, I wanted to be with the kids. And that's when I did the kiddies albums, and I worked with Old Mutual for these big choir.
If anyone thought you were just a singer, you've led quite an exciting creative life. You've done film soundtracks. I'm intrigued that you were doing documentaries on other countries. And
yeah, I just landed it. I landed my first movie soundtrack when I was just left the sweatband. I had to say no to the guy like 5 times. I said, I don't know how to do it. And he said, I like the way you sing. And I said, but I didn't write the songs of the sweatband either. So you must ask John to do it. You know, he said, no, but I want you to do it. And eventually someone said, just can say yes and then just book the right guys. So I did. So I booked Jethro, Denny Lillewet, Kevin Kruger.
Right.
I think Richard Mitchell. And can you imagine this snotty, wet behind the ears, 26-year-old rock chick saying, you know, it's quite scary in this part, and I can, like a sound on the bass that goes. I can just imagine. I think Jethro Buter hated my guts. It took about 20 years to get him to like me, because I can just imagine. So that's how I landed, because if you can think it, then you can do it. You just need to get the right people. So that's basically what I'm very good at, like being able to think things, explain it with my mouth.
Mm.
And then book the right people who understand my form of, who can speak my language.
Yeah.
And say yes to everything.
You released your last album, Salt. I think it was in 2021, wasn't it?
I think it was a catch and release program. Yeah. I'm not sure.
I was listening to it yesterday. It's perhaps the most introspective album you've done. It's filled with songs about the human condition.
Yes.
Do you feel like you've reached a point in your career where writing the perfect pop hit is not important, it's superfluous, and that you just want to take the opportunity just to express yourself, what you're feeling at that time?
Absolutely, Benji, in a nutshell, that's actually what you really want to do anyway all the time, is find a place to be able to – I don't listen to other music, especially if I'm pre-albuming or anything, because I don't want to be influenced at all in any way. I don't want to be. If I listen to anything, it's world music because it's another language. Mm. And also, I do want to be influenced by the timing of the vocals and that kind of thing. I'm super open to that kind of influence. But content and melody line and everything in that, I don't want to go, oh, God, that's like it happened before where I've seen it. Oh, no, I thought it was mine. And then have to rewrite or throw that piece away. So that's the thing, is to honestly be able to create something like, yeah, without any other influences, and to really feel like that, like it was written in that way.
Do you think that the way that the industry is now with streaming and Spotify and things like that is very much a single track driven kind of business? Do you still think there's space for albums, creative albums by independent artists that don't pander to the mainstream? And are you going to make another record after Salt?
Yeah. I think there are many artists who don't pander to the mainstream. I'm a big fan of Andrew Bird.
Mm, yeah.
I'm a big fan of Lisa Hannigan.
Mm-hmm.
Who sang with Damon Rice in Volcano. She's got a beautiful career, man. Wow. Mm. And they write stunning stuff. And that's like, I like artists like that you listen to and you listen to again and again. And the 10th time, you like cannot wait for that middle eight to come in or whatever. They write middle eights, by the way. They're those kind of – Hosea, he's just released a song, the pop guy. It's so beautiful. I'm like, that gives me hope. It's great. It's got a bridge, and then it's got a middle eight, and the way it's absolutely stunning. And I'm so glad that there are artists. It's a love song, but it's really done in a very interesting and nice way. The lyrics are worth it. The content is brilliant.
What is this burning thing that you have inside you to be creative, to keep pushing envelopes? What do you think? You've been doing this how long? 40 years?
It's the best job in the world, firstly. Because why would I like, you want to do anything else? To have a job that everything, well, most of the things you do, I mean, band practice for hours and hours because you love it. Mm. It's not like, oh, we got to go rehearse. Or even waiting to, I don't know, anything. It's nice work. The actual work is so rewarding that it's not work. You know that adage about if you find something you love, there will be shit to it. But because you love the thing so much, you just nom, 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 nom. and focus. And I woke up the other day going, shit, I really should have thought about making money. I just always thought I'd have it. I didn't think one would have to think about how you'd get it.
Mm.
Because fun was always my go-to. It was like, I want to do that. Looks fun. I want to hang out with those dudes. I want to do this. I never went, is it a viable financial decision?
Yeah.
Never once, ever. And so that was my primary, it was the push for me, is whatever was the most exciting thing for me to do, that was what I did. And I never thought about getting a number one hits or having a career, like what's next in your career. I don't know what's next. It's kind of just going forward and then, oh, I really love to do that. That's a great idea. And then get something together or collaborate with different people. Like you said, that's something I do a lot of. And it's a great reward because you bore yourself eventually.
So you sit and wait for the next thing to happen.
I just sing all the time, really. And I mean, I don't really practice guitar. I wrote the last album on guitar. I learned how to play guitar, writing the album. And I love playing drums. I jam with people a lot. It's very mind-releasing because you don't think of anything specific. I'm more interested in my son and daughter's musical career, if they wanted one. Mm-hmm. My son writes incredible. He writes very beautiful songs. He's a real natural, yeah, and he sings exquisitely. And he has a very unusual voice. And he's maybe because they've grown up in such a musical family and they sang on all the albums that I did and they've always been on stage with me and hauling them up. I go, sing for these people. They don't fight. They just go, okay, and they just sing for them, you know. And they, none of them want a career in music. But that's something that excites me now because I'll still keep writing, but I'm more interested in actually like developing youth. I think you become a teacher eventually. It's like a natural.
You go full circle.
Yeah, because I've got so much experience. I'm teaching singing now. It's more like finding your voice, all sorts of things. It eventually turns that way because you have to. You have to start imparting what you've learned.
Well, long may you keep writing great songs. Mm. Wendy Oldfield, it's been an absolute pleasure being with you today.
Thank you, Benji Moody, man. I hope it's not another 23
years before we see each other again.
That's but the best part about doing such a long career is you have like overview. We can say I saw someone the other day. Oh, it was about 7 years ago.
Or 23 years or whatever
Benji,
what it was.
You look fantastic.
Oh, thank you, Wendy. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure and it's very nice to be here.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.